Good morning. I'd like to welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals. We have one case on our oral argument docket this morning. I understand that counsel have shown up and announced that they are ready. Before we start, I'll introduce the panel that we have this morning. I'm Judge Elizabeth Kerr. To my left is Visiting Justice Rebecca Simmons, and to my right is Justice Wade Birdwell. And if we're ready, I'll ask the clerk to call the case.
The court will now call the matter of Kim F. the juvenile. May it please the court, Mr. Scott Brown to argue for the appellate, and Ms. Andrea Davis to argue for the state.
Mr. Brown?
I plead the court. So this case is a juvenile case. It involves appellant who was adjudicated delinquent of capital murder and two paragraphs of aggravated robbery. And the state's theory at trial and submitted to the jury was that the appellant acted as a party, not as a principal. The crux of the state's argument was that the appellant was sort of the mastermind, the planner. There was conflicting evidence about that or testimony about that, but that's the state's theory. There's no testimony whatsoever that the appellant was possessed a weapon or shot anybody or directly acted as a principal. So the basic sort of fact pattern was, in the state's theory, was that the appellant planned this robbery to rob her then boyfriend, and during the course of this robbery, there were two other individuals, adults, who were present in the house, and those individuals shot both appellant's boyfriend, who survived, and then the roommate who died. And so that's the state's theory of the case.
Let me just ask you, I noticed that in the fact statement there's a lot of background about the fact that MS was apparently trafficked. Does that have legal significance to the issues that we have to face here?
The issues that we're deciding here, it's not necessarily germane to those issues. For purposes of the trial, it was very significant because there was a duress argument presented to the court, to the jury. But I think what we're dealing with here is more, it's a pretty much a strict jury charge error. And based upon the facts that were presented to the jury, it's our position that the charge was erroneous. And juvenile cases are these sort of quasi-civil, quasi-criminal cases. And so if you start from the proposition that the rules of civil procedure apply, but significant sections of the Code of Criminal Procedure apply. So, for instance, the burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt. You have to have jury unanimity. And all the cases that you see that are juvenile cases and are in our appeals, the substantive law that is cited to control these cases is all criminal, because the charging instrument cites a penal law of Texas, and so it comes out of the penal code, and that's how the juvenile court gets jurisdiction to start with. And you find that in section 5103 of the family code, and it states that that's alleging conduct of a penal law of the state of Texas. And then you go one further and you look in section 1.03 of the penal code, and it tells you that conduct does not constitute an offense unless it is defined by a statute, a municipal ordinance, an order of a county commissioner's court, or a rule authorized by and lawfully adopted under statute. And that's key language. That's a specific statute in the penal code that controls what a criminal offense is. And if you back up and think about what I was just talking about, the case law that controls, even in my brief and the state's brief, and we're talking about charge error, there are different standards for charge error in civil court, sufficiency of the evidence, or charge error, sufficiency of the evidence, charge error when it's erroneous, when you reverse, and criminal. And Almanza from the criminal jurisprudence applies. If you're looking at sufficiency of the evidence, again, two different standards and the criminal standard, the weighing the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, always applies. And so, although in some regards we think of juvenile as civil, the cases that have come down are really leaning more towards it's getting more criminal because the person is being punished. And so criminal case law controls. So we look at this instruction. The problem with this instruction was that the appellant was prosecuted as a party, and the jury instruction contained all three possibilities, possible ways a person can be convicted or, in this case, adjudicated delinquent as a party. The one that we're really concerned about here is it included this charge that out of Penal Code 702A3 that appellant could be adjudicated delinquent if she had a legal duty to prevent this offense.
Now, do you disagree with the state that the concept of legal duty embraces the civil world and the cases that they cited for that proposition?
I 100% disagree with that.
Okay. Yeah, I'm interested to hear how you distinguish that notion that okay. The state brought up.
So the way that I distinguish that is if you look even at the cases that the state cites for that proposition, the case that the state cites, the initial civil case, it's a hazing case, and that is a case that let me jump a little forward then. If you think about civil cases and the negligence and that duty, if you were to apply that and say that under definitions 107A30 that a law is a written opinion by a court, and you jumped over and said then that means civil law, then we would be applying civil cases to all criminal cases, and we don't do that. And if you took that one step further, then you would say that in something we would think of as a negligence case would then somehow become criminal. So then, for instance, if a person was at a grocery store and spilled something on the ground, you know, some liquid on the ground, and knew they should clean it up, but they walked away and someone came along and slipped and fell on it and had a severe brain bleed such that they had serious bodily injury, well, then that person, under the state's theory, if you take it to its logical extreme, that person would be prosecuted for aggravated assault, serious bodily injury. And that's not what the penal code is designed to do. If that were the case, there would be simply no distinguishing factors between criminal cases and civil cases.
So how are we to define legal duty? If it's not defined in the penal code in a purely criminal context, how are we to define legal duty?
Okay. So if you look at even the case that the state cites, if you start with State versus Zaskovich, which is then that hazing case I was talking about, and this case was decided after Section 6.01 was amended to refer back to 1.07, so this would fall in line with a case that would, in theory, support the state's position. However, that case is the hazing case, and it says that as a matter of fundamental due process, notice of an offense must rest upon a specific statute. It also quotes affirmatively quotes a case called Billingsley versus State, which is at 780 Southwest 2nd, 271, and it essentially says, since the early days of the Republic and Texas statehood, Texas courts have been prohibited from allowing common law duties to form the basis of criminal sanctions. Conduct does not, and it quotes Section 103 of the Penal Code, Zaskovich, the case the state relies on, quotes, conduct does not constitute an offense unless it is defined as an offense by statute, municipal ordinance, or rule authorized by and lawfully adopted under statute.
Well, so what is the context? I mean, looking at the state's brief on page 20, and they quote part of a sentence saying that we've acknowledged that, quote, common law duties can form the basis for criminal prosecution, close quotes. So is there a larger context that snippet is from?
Yes, there is.
Okay.
So think about common law duties. Common law duties would be things like a spouse owes a duty to another spouse, or if you then look at the history of where did the injury to a child statute come from, an injury to an elderly, they really came from the common law concept that if you're a parent, or if you have assumed the duty to take care of someone medically, then you have then a duty not to omit. You have a duty to act to protect them. And so it's very different than to say that simply because you have been accused of and a jury has found that you planned something, you have to have a specific duty in relation to that person. And so if you look at the statutes that have incorporated the common law, things like the injury to a child, injury to an elderly, a police, or even the cases that the state cites.
Then why have the provision if the legal duty has to be defined by something that's already criminally prohibited, either in the penal code or in a criminal municipal ordinance or something of that nature? Then why use as the omission in the definition of parties the word legal duty when all they would have to do otherwise is just go charge the crime that the legal duty is defined by?
Well, we're dealing with, there's two different things. There's acting, and then there's,
well, there's three things.
Failing.
One, there's agency. There's A1 is agency, acting through an innocent person, by coercion, something of that nature. Two is commission, actually doing something affirmatively to aid, abet. And three is by omission, having a legal duty to act and failing to do so. How are we to define when someone has a legal duty to act? Because most of the crimes you're talking about are prohibitions. You may not act in this way. So why cannot we credit what the state is saying here? Because, again, we're dealing with a duty to act that's created by law in some way. How are we to determine the duty to act when all the statutes that you're saying we have to look to are prohibitions?
But what I would say is this. The state is relying on that one case the state can point to support their position that in this case, that particular act, this Buchanan case, and that case involves a vehicle that drove across a bridge and caused damage to the bridge, and then a person came along behind that and was injured, severely injured. And the problem with that case is the court eventually decided the case on the side of the defendant and said you didn't have a legal duty to decide that. So if you go through and read all the cases that the state cites, either they don't reach the conclusion that the state says they reach, or they are out of our jurisdiction. And so
Can I just go back? And I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Please go ahead. You had a final. So go ahead.
And so they're either not in our jurisdiction, or even if a duty is created, and it's our position that it's not, because the specific statute is going to control over the general statute, the specific statute of Penal Code 1.03, that's your controlling factor. Even if a duty is created, the case law is clear that the jury has to be charged on that duty. So the jury has to be told this duty exists. And again, if you look even at the state's cases that they cite, even these out-of-state cases, all of them on page 21, footnote 3, you've got Kuntz, which is a common law duty of spouse to spouse. The court charged that that had to be, the court gave them a charge on that. If you look at Raspberry, which is in the state's brief, the court charged that a police officer has to prevent.
And that's where I'm going to come back to you on the question. This is a unique charge to me when I reviewed it. So I'm going to direct you to the charge that was set forth. So they had the three types of principle in the, look like the abstract portion, what I would call an abstract portion. And normally, you know, extraneous statutory language and that sort of thing is normally not error. It's just considered extraneous, right, in the application process, right? Do you agree with that, or there's case law that, you know, for the most part?
Well, I think I would point back to the cases I cite on jury charges. The judge has an absolute duty to instruct the jury correctly.
Right.
And so if the judge takes it upon himself or herself to issue a charge, to include a charge on parties, that party's charge has to be tailored to the evidence.
But that, doesn't that happen in the application portion as opposed to the abstract? I'm just saying normally in an abstract portion I've seen cases that discuss additional statutory provisions that weren't particularly applicable to the case, right? And it wasn't erroneous because when they got to the application portion of the charge, they directed the jury's attention to the specific provisions of the charge. As we look at, is there error and was it egregious? I'm just wanting to make sure I understand the state's position on just by putting in the three types of party, you know, applications that you can have, that in your mind was erroneous.
Right.
Even though it's in the abstract portion.
It's in the abstract portion, and it shouldn't be there.
Right, right.
The duty shouldn't be there.
Okay.
And then the application paragraph, all it says is you can find appellant delinquent either as a principal or
right.
a party. So you're referring back to, so I agree,
okay.
the application paragraph is the heart and soul
right.
of.
Okay. That's okay. Yeah, that's what I'm.
And so they're
okay.
referred back to
okay.
it. Just like in Guevara.
Yeah.
Thank you, Counselor. Your time's expired. Would you please add 2 minutes to Ms. Jacobs' time?
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Andrea Jacobs. I'm here on behalf of the state, the appellee in this matter. I'm going to focus most, if not all of my time, on appellant's first four issues, as they appear to involve the juicier issue of legal duty. If I do not have time to address appellant's brief in his fifth issue, I will rest just on my brief. I'm going to prison. I accidentally got someone murdered. Those are the words that appellant spoke to her sister the day after the murder. In that moment, she admitted she created the danger. The underlying issue in appellant's first four grounds is whether it was legally possible for appellant to have a legal duty, because without that legal duty, there would be no offense.
Okay, so are you in agreement that that is the crux of this, that in fact, if the legal duty, and you are incorrect on that issue, that in fact, legal duty was read too broadly by the state, then do you agree then that there was error?
If I, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of that.
So in other words, if we don't buy the theory on legal duty, that you can import civil duties into, just wholeheartedly into the law of parties, and we accept the, that you can't, then is there error and do you believe it egregious?
No, I don't agree with that. I believe that in the Guevara case, the Court of Criminal Appeals specifically said, we do not hold whether or not this is error.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't believe that has been decided from the Court of Criminal Appeals, whether it is error. And we would argue that no, it wasn't error, because it is part of the statute. But more importantly, we would argue that even if it was error, it's not egregious.
Would you not agree that legal duty is an issue of law for the court?
I do agree.
Okay, so a jury is not supposed to be making a determination of what is or is not a legal duty. The jury is to be instructed as to what is or is not a legal duty and then apply the evidence to that instruction. Would you not agree?
I agree with that.
Okay, so where is the definition of legal duty from the trial court that was instructing the jury as to how they should apply the evidence with regard to A3?
Well, I believe that case law states that if there's not a statutory definition of a phrase, then it should not be defined in the jury charge.
Okay. Well, legal duty is pretty much defined all over the place, common law, etc. Okay, so it's a term of art. It's not something like help. Okay, it's not a common term. Legal duty is a term of art, and it is not defined. The case law you cite in your brief talks about common understood words that juries, lay people understand and can apply. Legal duty is not something that a lay individual would be able to apply. So how is a judge supposed to define legal duty for the jury as a matter of law when it's a legal term of art and does not do so here?
Well, I think in this situation, because it's such a, it's ingrained in our common law that you have a duty, when you create a danger, you have a duty to prevent harm, that that's just something that's so ingrained that I believe that is something that common understanding that a jury could pick up in that situation.
If okay. it's so ingrained, why aren't there Court of Criminal Appeals and other criminal cases that import this and have the same?
I could not find any cases. I don't know if, you know, if you look at Guevara, the only thing the state argued in that was just that a husband has a duty, like just because he's the husband. There was never any, you know, application of what he did or the actions that he took that would have created that legal duty. So I don't think just because it hasn't been presented doesn't mean it's not something that is so ingrained.
So what would you do if there was a plan, that in this case, if there had been a plan laid out and say MS had created the plan and used the lighter or whatever to create the rooms and had set it all up, but then had a moment of conscience and decided, no, I'm not going and I'm not going to do it. Was there a duty then for her to still warn because she'd participated in planning?
I think so, because you look at before what they've done before, during, and after, and I think that she would still have a duty because there's, you know, it's kind of like that. That reminds me of when, you know, when do you have to come back and say, oh, no, I changed my mind. But here, a situation where if she's done all that planning, I do think that that would create still, even, I believe, under the aiding, she'd also be a party. Mm-hmm. So it's not like it absolved her of right. legal under even our what we normally talk about when we talk about aiding. She's still a party. And so this is just another way for her to be to talk about the same facts differently, that she still be a party. So I believe in this situation specifically that because of the facts in this case and the aiding in this case and that it fell under both. And so it wasn't like if she had stepped back, she would no longer be a party at all. We would, you know, at a minimum, you'd still have the aiding. So I believe, yes, the legal duty. And if you look at law of the parties, it's not like they're different degrees. And so they are all the same. They're all similar. And so the issues in Guevara, the issues as to why this is a problem and whether this is error, is whether it was legally possible for her to have had a legal duty. And the state submits that, yes, it was legally possible that she had a legal duty because she was so involved in the planning and she was so involved.
So
in
where is the case law in your brief that identifies a duty under these circumstances? This isn't throwing a child into a pool and then having a legal duty to jump in and save the child. And, in fact, the common law is very clear that there's no common law duty to protect someone from crime, period. The only context that the civil courts have found that in is in the context of premises.
Well, I believe there was a case I believe I cited that talks about how if you've created the danger, actually you may have a duty over a third party's conduct if you've actually been involved and created that danger, put them in that situation.
Even in the context of parents for the criminal conduct or juvenile conduct of their children, there has to be a demonstration that they knew that their children were capable of doing. It's almost a first bite type of dog bite case. They had to know that their child was capable of taking that pencil and ramming it into their classmate in order for them to be held liable for what is clearly juvenile assault under the circumstances. So, again, even in that context, the court should have to define for the jury when a parent has a legal duty to prevent juvenile assault on behalf of their child. There's a special relationship even in those circumstances. But here, the term legal duty is bandied about without so much as a single reference to the jury in terms of what that means.
Well, I think in your example about the parent not knowing that the kid's going to poke the other kid in the eye with a pencil, if the parent gave the pencil or said, hey, go get a pencil, and you may have to poke that kid in the eye, then there may be a legal duty there that, you know.
But you still have to define the duty for the jury for them to be able to apply those facts under the law as it exists. And here, let's flip it. What you're basically saying is that in every case in which the state can make an aiding and abetting A2 type of argument under the law of parties, okay, that they automatically have an A3 under the circumstances where they can just simply say, well, okay, if you're not sure they really intended, et cetera, but they did all this stuff to set everything up and they didn't fix it. There's really very little distinction between the commission of A2 and the omission of A3 under the circumstances, and that's basically how this case got tried.
Well, but you can have a commission where they're actually involved, but they haven't been involved in the planning, and they haven't been involved to the degree that MS has been involved in this situation.
So what authority do you have that indicates that there's no real distinction, that basically if you violate A2, and the crime goes through, you violate A3.
But I'm not saying that. I don't think that that's always the case. I think in this situation, based on these facts, that she is both under A2 and A3. But I don't think in every situation where you have an aiding and abetting, you also have a legal duty, an affirmative act.
So when do you have a legal duty when there's not aiding and abetting? Because you're saying they created the dangerous situation, so normally that would be in the aiding and abetting. So when do you have it?
So it's like, I guess, if you have three, you also have two, but you can have two without three. I mean, because I can see if you have three, if you're involved with three and your level, you know, you have created this legal duty by creating the danger, then you've also been involved in the commission of the offense, either before, during, or after. Probably more of the before. But I don't think everybody who aids and abets under two is automatically also, you know, could be found under three.
Why not?
Well, because I think it's, you know, in this situation where you've actually created and you've been involved from the start, you can have a party who becomes a party after, who comes at the time, who gets brought in the last minute, like some of these, the co-defendants.
If you're charging A2, that means the crime went forward, okay? So aiding and abetting a specific crime that went forward, which means it was not prevented.
Mm-hmm.
A3 will apply every time A2, there's evidence supporting A2. There's no possible distinction because the crime will have been committed every time. It will not have been prevented.
Well, but if you have a person who just joined in, who just gets called in, says, okay, here's the gun, go and you're just going to do this, and doesn't involved in the planning, involved in creating the danger, they've just added on at the end. I don't think that them creating they haven't created the danger, they haven't created a legal duty to prevent the offense. I wouldn't think. I think, you know, they could, but I'm just saying, in this situation, I think it is so clear that she was so involved, so ingrained in the whole thing, that legal duty was created. I'm not saying that, you know, you spill something on the floor, and therefore, because you didn't clean it up and you didn't tell anybody, someone slips, you have a legal duty. I'm not saying that. I'm saying in this situation, based on these facts, she went so far into this the commission of this offense, the preparation of this offense, the planning of this offense, that she created that legal duty.
Do you know whether there's even a civil PJC, pattern jury charge, on assumption of duty?
I do not know the answer to that.
Okay.
But as for, like, no, I don't have any authority. If I had found authority, I'd put it in. What I just have is the statutes where they just kind of point you to, okay, this law. Because in 89 we had Billingsley, and Billingsley said, you know, a son does not have a duty to his mom because, in part, it's not under a statute. The legislature in 94 changed that to say, what, you know, legal duty isn't just under statute. We're going to defer to what is defined by law. And law now includes, you know, the written courts of record. They could have said written courts of criminal record. They could have said criminal ordinances, criminal rules, but they didn't. By law, the definition of law is defined by the Constitution or a statute of the state or of the United States. It used to be just of this state. A written opinion of the court of a court of record, not a criminal court of record, not in criminal cases, a municipal ordinance, an order of a county commissioner's court, or a rule authorized by and lawfully adopted under statute. Now in Zeskavage, yes, then they also noted that Billingsley had since been, that the law had since changed since Billingsley, and that common law could now be the basis for criminal prosecution.
So on this, in the civil side, you know, when you deal with duty and breaches of duty, you put that in the instruction, right? All the civil cases, that's in the instruction. And then, so the jury specifically pointed out the specific duty, right, that they then are going to decide, was it breached or not? In this case, I don't see how the jury was supposed to know what that duty was.
And I think that's a different issue than the issue that appellant argues. And when she talks about Guevara and how Guevara says it has to be all three, you got to prove. I think that is a separate issue, mm-hmm. and that's more of that is a jury charge error. Yes, but when we look at like the argument is that whether it was legally possible, then the court should look at that and go, you know. We look at it and say, yeah, it was legally possible she had a legal duty. Was the jury properly charged on that, I think, is a different issue, and we should look at the different factors about that under Almanza. It's still going to be Almanza. Nobody objected to the failure the jury charge to define legal duty. No one brought that up. And I think that is, you know, that is a separate issue about was that necessary? Was she egregiously harmed because the jury was not provided with the judge's definition or why the judge found legal duty. And I think if you look at that, then harm is not egregious under that, mm-hmm. because it was possible, and she did have created this danger. She did have this legal duty, and if they had looked at the evidence from that prism and pointed out that way, then there was, it wouldn't have denied her a fair trial.
But ultimately, we don't know which theory they found her guilty under, either A2 or A3, do we?
That is true. But if you look at the evidence, I disagree with that. Because if you look at the evidence, you look at the jury charge, the court's arguments, how everything was funneled, the state's theory, it was all clear that this was an aiding and abetting argument. Yes, the state did mention that she didn't stop it, but that was in clear response to her argument that she was under duress. The state argued, you know, if she was under duress, then wouldn't she have taken an opportunity to tell somebody or warn somebody? But she didn't, therefore she was a willing participant. The state never argued she had a legal duty, and the state never pointed that out, and they never focused on that. It was all about whether she was involved in the commission, which is an act as opposed to an omission. And the facts in this case are so clear that she committed the offense as a party, not that she failed to, that the issue was that she failed to warn. And so, I think that if you look at the facts in the case, I believe the jury, they were led down that, all about her commission, what she did, what she agreed to, and how she was involved, not how she failed to do something. And I think that's a problem. If you have a problem with legal duty and you want to say it is a more difficult burden, or if it has a different standard, or that, you know, there has to be something different about it, it's all because it's criminalizing an omission, a failure to act, which, you know, if there's not a legal duty present, then we shouldn't be criminalizing acts, because, you know, unless there's a legal duty, there's a reason that they had a requirement that they act, that they act. Here, it was all a case of commission. It was all a case of action. And all the state put on, and all the state argued, and everything was to show that, no, she aided and abetted. Yes, the jury wasn't asked under which prong you find. But I think the evidence was so overwhelming, and everything was presented to them in such a way that they went with, she acted. This was a commission. This was an action and not an omission.
But that's from just jury argument. It's not just looking at what the charge that the jury was given, right? You're relying on the fact of what was argued in closing argument.
Right, including regarding about the charge and how the state actually pointed the charge. Riley, when he argued the charge, he skipped over legal duty. He went on about he talked about aiding and abetting, and he actually, I think, said something to the effect of, and even this piece right here, this is where you really need to see it. You know, this is where you need to focus. And so, but he didn't even mention the legal duty. Nobody mentioned legal duty. I don't think.
I wonder if they thought it applied.
I don't know why it was in there, if it was, you know, an accident. I don't know what. But the reality is even though it's in there, it still could have been proper. We could have proven legal duty. If you look at the statute for how you define legal duty as defined by 107, 107 talks about, you know, civil opinions, and yes, the judge probably should have put in more. I mean, yes, there was no definition of legal duty. There was no explanation to the jury. Now,
but arguing evidence of failure to warn, that evidence would support both the aiding and abetting and the omission, A2 and A3. So how is a jury without instruction to determine how to apply that evidence?
Well, I believe when, I believe that when the state said she failed to do this and put it in context, the jury had it in context. This is to show she's a willing participant, and I believe I point that in my brief with specific examples how this is all about. She's a willing participant. She didn't warn. She didn't do this. She could have done this. She didn't do this. It wasn't she is guilty because she didn't do this. It was she was a willing participant in that she acted and committed in this because, she, you know, and the evidence of that is that she did that.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
I'd like to address this concept of, well, even if there was so much evidence of aiding, that then that supports the jury's verdict. As it makes clear on page 14 of my brief, it's in Guevara, it's in Supreme Court decisions, that is an evidentiary sufficiency issue, and what we're dealing with here is a legal deficiency to the charge. And so if you look at, again, page 14 and 15 of my brief, Guevara makes clear that if the challenge, and we all know that, if the challenge is evidentiary, as long as the verdict is supported by the evidence and any rational trier of fact could find in favor of the state, then that supports the verdict. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're dealing with legal deficiency in the charge, and that's pretty much just the opposite. If the challenge is legal and any of the theories are legally insufficient, then the verdict must be reversed. That comes from Guevara. And while I'm on that point, the state argues that Guevara is not a good precedent. Well, it is an appellate case from the state of Texas, and the Court of Criminal Appeals refused PDR. The Court of Criminal Appeals had a chance to look at that. They, in fact, did look at it once and sent it back to the Court of Appeals for a harm analysis and then refused the state's PDR. It is certainly better precedent in this case than civil cases, than cases from other jurisdictions, and cases from federal court. So it's a little just disingenuous for the state to argue that a case from the state of Texas is not binding precedent or not good precedent. Back to this concept of legal deficiency versus evidentiary sufficiency. The reason we have that, the Supreme Court has stated, and it's in my brief on page 15, that jurors are not generally equipped to determine whether a particular theory of conviction submitted to them is contrary to the law. The jury decides the facts, but you've got to give them the law that applies. And I do argue, and appellant does argue in our brief on page 10, that this duty, if there was a duty, then it should have been defined and it was not defined. We do put that in there.
But in the application paragraphs of the charge, when it talks about, I don't have it right in front of me, but where there's the disjunctive, either as a principal or a party.
Yes.
Are you saying that the jury could not have picked up on that word party and been thinking under A2 and not A3?
I'm saying the case law supports the concept and is solid on this, that application paragraph has referred the jury back to an erroneous jury charge in the abstract, and assume
if the abstract portion had only said legal duty, that would be one thing, but it also had the alternative, right, the aiding and abetting concept. So,
and the case, I understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. The case law is clear from Guevara to Supreme Court precedent that if a jury is given that kind of choice and they're given a general verdict and you cannot tell which one they decided the case based upon, then that's error, and it's harmful error. And if I could, in the brief minute I have left, I want to talk about statutory construction, why 107, this definition that talks about written opinions of court, does not apply. It doesn't incorporate all civil cases. We think of, you want to try to harmonize the penal code, you want to try to harmonize statutes, give them a common sense reading. And so if we have 103 that talks about the conduct that is criminalized and has to be in a statute, And if you read, if you look at it, this comes from the penal code. It's logical then that these written opinions that they're talking about are penal or criminal cases. The legislature is not required to lay everything out and tell us things that are logical that we can figure out. If we want to know what civil rules apply, we look at the rules of civil procedure. If we want to look at civil precedent, we look at civil cases. If we want to look at criminal cases and criminal precedent, we're using the penal code, the code of criminal procedure, and criminal cases. So you can't make this illogical leap that the state wants you to make.
So the only so the only possible legal duty in your argument that could possibly be criminalized in A3 is a penal code provision that criminalizes omission of some kind.
Well, it's not always a penal code provision, but it could be.
I thought
be,
that's what I heard you just say.
It could be from some other code. So for instance, like I believe there are some
municipal ordinance or something of that
deal
nature.
Deal with police officers and their duty, and that's in that Raspberry case. So it doesn't necessarily have to come from the penal code, but it needs to come from a statute.
But it still has to be a statutorily defined duty to act, that it's a crime to omit to act.
To act. And then if a common law case expounds upon that, then you don't need to give the jury that entire definition of what's in the case, but you still have to, if there is a duty, and I still don't see how the state's pointed to a duty in the state of Texas.
Okay.
For appellant act.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, counsel, thank you for the argument. It's been very helpful. And with that, your case is submitted, and you are free to go. Thank you very much. Sure.